This is day four of this April 2013 seven-day session, and we'll resume reading from our text from the first 3 days. It's called Instant Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary, and it's a collection of lectures and other teachings by the 12th century Chan master Foyen. Generally speaking, practical application of Zen requires detachment from thoughts. This method of Zen saves the most energy. It just requires you to detach from emotional thoughts and understand that there is nothing concrete in the realms of desire, form, and formlessness. Only then can you apply Zen practically. If you try to practice it otherwise, it will seem bitterly painful by comparison. Detachment from thoughts. This is Zazen, isn't it? This is the process, the work. First noticing the thoughts, that's the hard part, because we can be dwelling in thoughts for the longest time without realizing it, and we can't realize it till we realize it. So the first step is to notice it and then go back to the practice. Sometimes people phrase it in terms of letting go of the thoughts, which is okay, but strictly speaking, even that is unnecessary, because if we just put the attention back on the practice, that's the letting go. We don't have to add a new step to let go of the thoughts. No, just swing one's attention back to the practice, whether it's a breath or a koan or whatever it is. We can use our attention like a flashlight or a searchlight. We can direct it any way we want, once we are aware, once we notice what our mind is doing, then we can choose to direct our attention where we want. And that's always in Zen. It's back to this practice of no-mindedness, this realm of no thought, which is mu and every other practice. This is where the accumulation of samadhi power really helps. Samadhi power, meaning the power to hold the mind on one thing or direct it back to that one thing. The Japanese word is joriki. Joriki is this force where we have the strength to redirect our attention, because everyone knows what it's like to notice thoughts and still go on lingering in them. People sometimes will when they notice that their mind has wandered, they'll say, "Okay, I'll get back to the practice in just a minute. I just want to just let me finish this up, and you know, then I'll get back to it." That's where faith comes in. If you only someone with some faith in the value of thoughts would do that. You may not think of yourself that way. You may think, "All right, I'm just going to just wind this up." But if you really have seen into how thoughts are futile, not for everything, they have a place, thinking has a place, but in terms of resolving the great matter, thoughts are useless. And time is passing. And so we have to be clear that when we catch ourselves in thoughts, to just get back to the practice. And that gets easier as this joriki, this energy that results from, this builds up from concentration, as that grows, it gets easier to direct our attention where we know it belongs, at least where it belongs in these circumstances where we have no responsibilities that require the use of the higher mind, the intellect. Detachment from thoughts. This method of Zen saves the most energy. This is a curious phrase that crops up in lots of the texts of Chan that I've read from. Saving the energy, the idea of saving energy, conserving energy. It's true, for sure, that so much of our energy, mental energy, other kinds of energy, is drained just through idle thoughts. This is why, as Sesshin goes on, we notice we have more energy. In spite of going with less sleep often, we still have more energy because we're spend less of our waking hours dwelling in thoughts. It just requires you to detach from emotional thoughts. I have to be frank. I'm not sure what this means. I mean, we know that when we are experiencing an emotion, that thoughts very often go with that, or maybe always. I don't know how you would document that, but for example, anger. If we notice that we're angry in some way, then we're almost bound to have thoughts about the person or persons or thing that we're angry about. But it's almost like now he's putting a modifier on thoughts. He says it just requires you to detach from emotional thoughts. Well, how about the other thoughts that aren't emotional? But probably the stickiest thoughts, the most tenacious, are the ones that are enmeshed in emotional states. And understand that there is nothing concrete in the realms of desire, form, and formlessness. These are what are called the three worlds. And this is a very common formulation in Buddhist texts, the three worlds. Sometimes, or the three realms, sometimes it means past, present, and future, but usually it means these realms of desire, form without desire, and the realm of formlessness. Basically, everything, every kind of phenomenon we can possibly conceive of is within one of these three realms. So it's a way of saying there's nothing concrete, nothing substantial, that's imaginable. Nothing has any substance to it. Only then can you apply Zen practically. And then he tells the story. This is connected to his phrase, the emotional thoughts, about the monk, the Vinaya monk, who stepped on the eggplant and in the dark and freaked out because he thought it was a frog or a toad, and all the eggs, and he would be suffering the consequences of having taken life. And then he finds out that it was just an eggplant the next morning. We read this on the first day of Sesshin. Won't go through it again. But just again, that it's a perfect example or illustration of how we project our mind onto what we experience, what's in our mind, and how our perceptions are determined by the mind, the condition of the mind, and what's in it. There's a nice little verse, though, at the end of that story that I'll read. Feelings of frogs may be shed, he's referring to in the morning when he realizes it was just, he goes back and he sees it was just an eggplant. Feelings of frogs may be shed, but the idea of eggplant remains. If you would be free of the idea of eggplant, strike the evening chime at noon. So this is very basic Buddhist teaching, that even to say, oh, it's not a frog, it's an eggplant, can be self-deceptive. We think that because we give something a name, then we know what it is. Well, we know what it means, we know what the name is, but do we know what it is? Without words, without names. So people work on the koans, what am I, who am I, recognizing that the name they were given when they were born is just that, just a certain sequence of letters. He says this a little bit later, I marked here. An ancient said, everywhere is you. Go east and it's you, go west and it's you. Who are you? If you say, me, this is emotional and intellectual consciousness which you must pass through before you attain realization. Quotes an ancient. The Buddhas and Zen masters have given a clear and detailed explanation of what is beyond words, but most of those who get here are confused, muddled, and uncomprehending. If you don't see this, you are asleep on your feet. You are always in the light, and yet do not know it, even with your eyes open. How do you expect me to do anything for you? What do you people come to me for? Each individual should lead life autonomously. Don't listen to what other people say. An ancient declared, I knew how to lead life by the time I was 18. It's the end of the quote. And then Fo Yen says, You people must learn to live independently. He's not talking, of course, about financial independence or living apart from one's family, one's parents, but not looking to others to be authentic. How could you be authentic as long as you're basing it on what others expect of you or want of you? I knew how to lead life by the time I was 18. You say, lead what life? Just do not seek elsewhere. Most people today are compulsively active. This is already not knowing how to lead life. This is called abandoning home, scattering the family, and becoming a drifter. Clearly, this is not understanding. Just searching and seeking, studying a bit of intellectual knowledge, memorizing a few sayings is called hauling manure inside. That's another thing about these Chinese texts. They love to say, this is called, or this is what we call. When you get here, your actions have to be truly accurate. Eventually, it will sink in thoroughly, and then you will understand. Accurate. Well, one way to understand that, certainly in Sesshin, is to be conscientious about the forms, the procedures, the guidelines. For some people, it takes a long time to appreciate how fortifying to one's practice these are, to everyone's practice. Most of these things are just matters of consideration, not doing things that are likely to distract other people. But not only that, there are also ways of not indulging our preferences, our self-partiality. As long as we have the chance to just do whatever we want, whenever we want to, we will not really have a chance to see what's beyond preferences. I suppose a lot of Sesshin is just cornering the ego, just hemming it in, so it can't. We take away its wiggle room, really pin it down, so it can't work its mischief. Most people in the world would not want that. They just want to be able to do what they want when they want to do it. But really, where does that get us? There's a great scene in one of the Japanese samurai movies where this wild, uncouth samurai warrior who just drives everyone crazy with his outlandish behavior. He finally lands at the doorstep of a Zen priest at a temple, and the priest, this is going back decades from what I can remember, the priest finds a way to tie him up and have him hanging upside down from a tree branch. And he's all tethered up like in a straitjacket, but it's just ropes, and he's hanging there, howling and fuming and sputtering, and then the Zen priest just smiles agreeably, and the movie suggests that this goes on not just for hours, but maybe a day or two, and this wild man gradually settles down. And then you see the transformation where the priest gets him out of the tree, lets him down, and now he's a new man. He's someone of dignity, maturity. It's an allegory. And we can see it as what we can become by just lashing down this ever-grasping, wanting mind so that it can't continue indulging itself. When you get here, your actions have to be truly accurate. Eventually, it will sink in thoroughly, and then you will understand. Don't say that what is speaking right now is it. That's not quite right. As soon as there is an affirmation, then there is a negation. That is the reason why it is said that no verbal expressions correspond to this reality. This sounds can sound pretty philosophical, but it's true nonetheless. As soon as we make an assertion, an affirmation, this is a table, we're already wrong, because it's just the name. It's really energy in flux. We can't detect it with the limitations of our senses, but this is just a certain form of congealed energy in a pattern. That is a dynamic thing, but because it's dynamic, it's not a thing. It's not a fixed thing. As soon as we make the statement, "This is it," or "That is it," then it is by definition, it's limited. It stands apart linguistically. It stands apart from what is not it. And that's the problem with words. No verbal expressions correspond to this reality. So then what? Well, he says, that is why the sages compassionately told us to tune into the source of our own minds. Now tell me, what is the source of mind to which one tunes in on one's own? This is a little bit of an odd translation, tune in. Come into harmony, come into accord with the source of the mind. How do we do that? Well, you know, don't you? Just mu, just the breath, just whatever koan is, just shikantaza. That's what he's referring to, Foyan is referring to here. We come into accord with this self-nature of ours by detaching from thoughts, not letting ourselves pursue thoughts. He says if you mindfully try to tune into mind, you will definitely be unable to tune in. You have to tune in with mindless mind. So long as we are utilizing the conscious mind to accomplish something, okay, I'm going to tune into the source of mind. Here we go. Then it inevitably involves self-consciousness. Self-consciousness. Instead, in Zen we talk about no-mindedness. Just allowing the mind to settle, not trying to create an effect, but just letting go into the breath or the koan or whatever. And then it happens, by and by it happens on its own. It's not us doing it. It could never be us doing it, because there's no us. There's no I or me who can do anything. In the deepest sense, such things don't exist. They're just creations of the mind. These pronouns, and either personal pronouns or possessive pronouns, I, me, my, ours. It happens. It happens when we're not pursuing thoughts. This goes back to this common advice we find in Zen texts of don't strive, don't try to do something. He goes on. You must be attuned 24 hours a day before you attain realization. Have you not read how Ling Yun suddenly tuned into this reality on seeing peach blossoms falling? How Shang Yan set his mind at rest on hearing the sound of bamboo being hit? These are two very famous cases of instances of masters, great masters coming to awakening. The one of seeing peach blossoms falling is quite unusual, because most awakenings that we read about don't happen through sight, through seeing something. More happen through sound or touch. The other one, Shang Yan, this is King Yu, in the Japanese, he struggled and struggled with his question, and finally in despair he gave up, and he just decided he would just settle for tending the grave at a certain little temple. And one day while he was sweeping the ground, a pebble with his broom, the broom flicked a pebble against a bamboo tile, and it made this, and with that he came to awakening. He had no intention. He wasn't working on coming to awakening. He just had forgotten about that, and he was just, he must have been fully absorbed in what he was doing, with no beyond thought. That's the precondition of awakening. It's so difficult, though, to reach that state where we can really let go of our project and just truly merge with the practice for its own sake, not as a way to get something. That's the problem. That's the difficulty. To take such an intense interest in our koan, in the breath itself, and the breath is tremendously interesting when we really deeply look into it. Take to such an intense interest in the object that we're concentrating on that we forget any goals. An ancient said, if you are not in tune with this reality, then the whole earth deceives you, the environment fools you. Well, in the sense that we still would see it as apart from us. The reason for all the mundane conditions abundantly present is just that this reality has not been clarified. I could take this as the reason that things seem mundane, just everyday life, boring, is because this is not really, this great matter has not been clarified. I urge you for now to first detach from gross mental objects. 24 hours a day, you think about clothing, you think about food, you think all sorts of various thoughts. You're like the flame of a candle burning unceasingly. Just detach from gross mental objects, and whatever subtle ones there are will naturally clear out, and eventually you will come to understand spontaneously. You don't need to seek. This is called putting conceptualization to rest and forgetting mental objects, not being a partner to the dusts of thought. Just detach from gross mental objects. Don't know for sure what he means here. Certainly, the object, the self as an object, thinking about oneself, that's about as gross as it gets. And he says, the only essential thing in learning Zen is to forget mental objects and stop rumination. This has been the message of Zen since time immemorial. Didn't one of the patriarchs say, freedom from thoughts is the source, freedom from appearances is the substance? Let me give you an illustration. People have eyes by which they can see all sorts of forms, like long and short, square and round, and so on. Then why do they not see themselves? Just perceiving forms, you cannot see your eyes even if you want to. Your mind is also like this. Its light shines perceptibly throughout the 10 directions, encompassing all things. So why does it not know itself? Do you want to understand? Just discern the things perceived. You cannot see the mind itself. An ancient said, the knife does not cut itself, the finger does not touch itself, the mind does not know itself, the eye does not see itself. This is true reality. the second patriarch, Wei Ko, came to Bodhidharma, the first patriarch of Zen, and said, my mind is still not at peace. I beg you to put it to rest. Bodhidharma said, well, bring me this mind and I'll put it to rest. To which the second patriarch said, well, I have searched for this mind. I've searched for it and I can't find it. To which Bodhidharma said, then I have put it to rest. And that's when he came to awakening. How could we see the mind? What is the mind anyway? This thing we give this word to, mind. What does that mean? Where is this mind? Where does it start and where does it end? Where would you draw the line around your mind? The brain, we know, is an organ. This mass of tissue that we can define. But mind? The mind, we know, we can be sure, is way more than the brain. But how much more? How far does the mind extend? Another entry here. If someone should question you, how would you speak? Can you speak effectively? If you can only speak after thinking and concentrating, what use is your statement? At midnight, how do you speak? Getting up at dawn, how do you speak? In the hallway, in the washroom, how do you speak? Can you speak effectively? Your eyes must be clear before you can. If you can only speak after thinking, what use is what you say? Then we have this emphasis on no gaps. Someone calls, you respond. In the gap, the gaps are where thoughts scurry in. In English, we have this we're talking and our mind is whirring and we fill that in with or like Jackie Gleason, humana, 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 when Alice caught him red-handed at something. In Mexico, it's este. This is the sort of delay when you're trying to find the right word or the right thing to say. Just now, an assistant came and announced that the rain isn't stopping, and people may not be able to hear if a meeting is held in the rain. Supposing the rain stopped right now, then would you hear? I say it's best when the rain doesn't stop. Why? Because you are not deliberately trying to listen. How about when they say the sound of the rain has given you a tasho? Is that correct? I don't agree. The sound of the rain is you giving a tasho. But do you understand? Clarify directly. Then what else is there? The sound of the rain is you giving a tasho. As soon as you rationalize, it's hard to understand. That is, as soon as you flee into thoughts, you must refrain from rationalization before you can attain realization. Hearing such talk, some people immediately declare, "I have nothing to say at all, and no reason either." They do not realize this is, in fact, a rationalization. Yeah, it's a notion. Those people he's referring to, they have this notion that's the way to be. I have nothing to say, no reason. I will settle something for you right now. The ultimate rule is to see your own mind clearly. This is what Buddhism is, as far as I am concerned. To see your own mind clearly. One aspect of this seeing the mind is one that we can all speak from our experience in Zazen, especially in Sesshin, is seeing what contents of the mind are revealed as we sit hour after hour. We come to see the patterns that we are subject to, the places we consistently go, the thought reactions we have habitually. So this is the great paradox of doing Zazen, is that the more thoroughly we are dwelling in this no mind, the more clearly we see the contents of the mind. We see the thoughts. We see the emotional states. We see the fears. We see the attachments, the ways in which we cling, the ways in which we habitually react to people and circumstances. All of this is on full display the more we are dwelling in non-dwelling, the more we are abiding in non-abiding, the more thoroughly we are one with mu, one with the breath, we will come to see of the mind and its stuff and our issues. This is enormously valuable part of Zazen. This is not the ultimate point, because ultimately we want to see beyond all this stuff, beyond all of our issues, our self-concerns. But while we're at it, we're on our way there, then we are given quite a display of how the mind works. The trick is not to get caught in any of that stuff. We can have these little insights, about the workings of the mind, insights, little psychological insights. We can have little philosophical insights. But then to go beyond that, we have to discard those. Let them go. Let them go again by just turning the mind back to the practice. Too many people get hung up on things they see about themselves, things that may be painful, that they may feel ashamed about, or proud of. This is why it's so difficult, why so few people persist at this, because we keep getting snagged in this stuff in the mind, rather than just seeing it and moving through it, letting it go. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.